Chapter 24, Daniel. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be brought to ruin. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, and it itself will stand to times indefinite. Daniel is one of the most intriguing and profound prophetic books in the Bible. Basically, Daniel was given a brief outline of the progression of the primary world powers from the Babylonian Empire to the last kingdom that is destined to be directly vanquished by the kingdom of the heavens. However, Daniel did not merely write down the prophetic visions he was privileged to record. Daniel and his three Hebrew companions directly participated in a series of prophetic dramas, and in so doing have provided portents of God's future dealings during the time of the end. In the opening scene of the book of Daniel, we are introduced not to the mighty monarch of Mesopotamia, Nebuchadnezzar, but to three lowly Hebrew captives in Babylon. Their names were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, better known by their Babylonian names, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The three Hebrews, along with Daniel, who was apparently their senior spokesman, had been princes belonging to the elite of Jewish society, who had been among the first wave of exiles to be deported to Babylon before Jerusalem was completely destroyed. Apparently, Nebuchadnezzar's policy was to educate individuals of noble birth from throughout the realm of the empire in the ways of Babylon. They were then to be deployed as governmental agents, perhaps as translators, or even as satraps, envoys, and counselors of the king. The program involved immersing the captives into Babylon's religion and culture. The Hebrews even underwent the indignity of being given Chaldean names. This was all the more humiliating in view of the fact that many Hebrew names had religious, perhaps even prophetic, significance. For example, the name Hananiah means Jehovah has shown favor. The name Mishael, a variation of Michael, means who is like God. Azariah means Jehovah has helped. Their being given Babylonish names meant that the princes of Judah were stripped of their identity as Jehovah's witnesses. As regards Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar directly stated that he had christened Daniel Belteshazzar, according to the name of my God. But although they were prisoners in a faraway land, they were actually treated as royalty. In fact, they were fed from the royal table. That presented a problem, though. Undoubtedly, the king's fare contained foods that were forbidden by Jewish law. So Daniel and his brothers were determined not to pollute themselves with Babylon's wine and the delicacies peculiar to the king's court. Daniel requested that they be given mere vegetables and water instead. Although their overseer was concerned that their health may suffer as a result, at the end of a 10-day test period, Daniel and his friends proved to be healthier looking than their counterparts, who drank the king's wine and ate the king's food. As a result of their relying upon Jehovah, God blessed them. And as for these children, the four of them, to them the true God gave knowledge and insight in all writing and wisdom, and Daniel himself had understanding in all sorts of visions and dreams. Subheading: 10 times better than all the magic practicing priests. Question: what do the prophecies of Daniel, Ezekiel, and Revelation have in common? Answer: significantly, Daniel, Ezekiel, and the Apostle John were all three in a captive condition to the very empires that make up the composite wild beast of prophecy when Jehovah unveiled his prophetic messages to them. That being the case, Daniel and the princes from the royal realm of the city of Jehovah being taken into captivity in Babylon must surely foreshadow how Christ's princes of the holy place are destined to go into captivity to the eighth king and be subjected to the authority of the Babylonish harlot of Revelation that will sit upon the symbolic wild beast during the final denunciation. Finally, the time came for them to stand before the king to be judged. And the account says of them, "And at the end of the days that the king had said to bring them in, the principal court official also proceeded to bring them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king began to speak with them, and out of them all no one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and they continued to stand before the king. And as regards every matter of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired about from them, he even got to find them 10 times better than all the magic-practicing priests and the conjurers that were in all his royal realm. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were faithful in what was least, the least being, in this instance, their adherence to the dietary restrictions of the Code of Moses. And Jehovah rewarded them for their obedience in this matter, giving them greater wisdom than all of the king's Chaldean counselors. But much greater tests were to come upon them, tests of integrity that would involve their very lives. The faithfulness of the Hebrew princes during a time of testing foreshadows how Christians must refuse to pollute themselves with the wine of Babylon the Great during their captivity. And although they were not imprisoned in literal cells, the captive Jews being further put to the test 10 days finds a parallel in Revelation, where Jesus forewarned the Smyrna congregation, "Look, the devil will keep on throwing some of you into prison, that you may be fully put to the test, and that you may have tribulation 10 days. Prove yourself faithful even to death, and I will give you the crown of life." As a society has correctly discerned, the number 10 is used in prophecy as a symbol of earthly completeness. In regards to being put to the test for 10 days, it symbolizes how the earthly members of Christ's anointed congregation will ultimately fulfill Jehovah's purpose in connection with them before they leave this earth for their heavenly reward, being completely put to the test. They're being found 10 times better than all the magic-practicing priests and conjurers in all the royal realm is a portent of how the wisdom of this world will be brought to nothing when the sons of the kingdom are ultimately filled with all wisdom and spiritual comprehension in connection with the manifestation of Christ through them. As a consequence of their being found fitter than their non-Jewish contemporaries, Daniel became a permanent advisor to the court of the king, and his 3 Hebrew companions were appointed over the administration of the jurisdictional district of Babylon. That development fittingly foreshadows how the chosen ones will stand before kings and governors during the conclusion of the system of things in order to give them a thorough witness, as Jesus Christ foretold, and no one will be able to hold their own against them, as was also portrayed by Stephen's dramatic final witness to the Jewish High Court. Subheading: A God in the Heavens Who Was a Revealer of Secrets. The curtain lifts on scene 2 of the prophetic drama of Daniel, with Nebuchadnezzar in an extremely agitated state over a dream he had dreamt, or perhaps a series of dreams. The reason the king became so disturbed is because his was no ordinary dream. The God of the heavens had implanted a vivid vision in his mind, startling images he could not shake off, even upon awakening. How deeply Nebuchadnezzar must have been shaken by the vision may be better appreciated in light of the fact that most people back then were very superstitious, especially the rulers. They relied heavily upon discerning omens and deciphering dreams, and made very weighty decisions based upon the occult practice of divination. As an example, when Nebuchadnezzar's invading army reached a fork in the road, with one path leading to Jerusalem and the other passing it by, the commander of the world's most powerful army of that day made a strategic military decision by means of divination. The account at Ezekiel 21:21 states, "For the king of Babylon stood still at the crossways, at the head of the two ways, in order to resort to divination. He has shaken the arrows. He has asked by means of the teraphim. He has looked into the liver." On this particular occasion, Jehovah made sure that the omens the priest interpreted for the king pointed to Jerusalem. The point is, though, the magic-practicing priests and conjurers held tremendous power in the kingdom, and that is why the disturbed emperor hastily summoned all the wise men and Chaldean conjurers of his court in order to consult with them over the disturbing dream. But the shrewd king made a most unusual request of his wise men. Instead of telling the Chaldean magi his dream and allowing them to fabricate various plausible meanings, Nebuchadnezzar demanded that they first tell him what he had dreamt, and if they could do that, then he would know that their interpretation of it was trustworthy. Understandably, the Chaldeans responded saying, "There does not exist a man on the dry land that is able to show the matter of the king, for as much as no grand king or governor has asked such a thing as this of any magic-practicing priest or conjurer or Chaldean. But the thing that the king himself is asking is difficult, and nobody else exists who can show it before the king except the gods, whose own dwelling does not exist with flesh at all." The king's counselors spoke the truth. What the king of Babylon was asking them to do was humanly impossible. Only a god could tell Nebuchadnezzar what he had dreamed, or more specifically, only the true God. Nevertheless, the king became so enraged at their failure to deliver what he had demanded that he gave the order that all of the wise men and magic-practicing priests in his court be killed. And not just killed. If they proved incapable of telling the king his dream, they would be dismembered and their homes turned into public toilets. And because the four Hebrew princes were also associated with the royal court of counselors, they too faced certain death. When informed of the grave situation confronting them, Daniel immediately petitioned the king for a stay of execution, not only for himself, but also for all of the wise men of Babylon. By Jehovah's mercy, his request was granted. Daniel then supplicated Jehovah his God. Shortly thereafter, as Daniel lay sleeping one night, the God of the heavens whispered the secret matter to him in a dream. Daniel thanked Jehovah from the bottom of his heart and then rushed into the palace to reveal to the perplexed king not only precisely what he had dreamt, but what it meant as well. As a humble servant of God, Daniel made it clear that his making these matters known to the king was not due to any wisdom of his own. And as a result, the one whom Daniel addressed as the King of Kings, Nebuchadnezzar himself, also acknowledged the supremacy of Daniel's God, saying, Truly, the God of you men is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, because you were able to reveal this secret." Jehovah chose that particular moment in history to insert himself into human affairs for a reason. The account states that Nebuchadnezzar had this extraordinary dream in the second year. This, however, is not in reference to the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, but to the second year since the emperor had destroyed Jerusalem and pillaged the very temple of Jehovah. Because with Jerusalem reduced to a smoldering ruin, and the Ark of the Covenant likely among the sacred treasures hauled off to Babylon as a trophy of their triumphant military expedition, and the princes of the holy place in captivity in the land of Marduk, and the God-ordained throne of David seemingly permanently blotted out of existence, and virtually every people and nation in the region subjugated to the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar truly became the king of all earthly kings, including the kings who were once said to have sat upon Jehovah's throne. It is rich with prophetic significance that Jehovah became the revealer of secrets in the aftermath of the destruction of his earthly throne and holy temple. For in the grander fulfillment of prophecy, during the time of the end, the very same revealer of secrets will unseal all that is presently hidden. Daniel revealed to Nebuchadnezzar that the golden head of the dreadful image represents the king of Babylon himself. But the purpose of the dream was as Daniel stated. The revealer of secrets has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what is to occur in the final part of the days. Although the golden crown-bearing head symbolizing Nebuchadnezzar is the most prominent feature of the image, it is in the final part of the days that the dream will ultimately be realized, culminating with the entire human political scheme being crushed and replaced by the kingdom of heaven. As regards the second chapter of Daniel, the metallic colossus with the head of gold supported on the feet of iron and clay represents a single composite kingdom that is ultimately shattered by the stone not chiseled by human hands. Presently, the watchtower does not recognize the image itself as representing anything other than non-specific human rulership. Furthermore, the watchtower interprets the iron and clay making up the toes and feet of the image to symbolize an indistinct, politically divided world. However, that interpretation is inconsistent and violates the natural order of the previous metals that make up the image. That is because each metal represents a separate and distinct empire in a uniform progression that began with Babylon, followed by the Persian, Grecian, and Roman empires. How is it, then, that the feet of iron and clay represents a nondescript, politically divided world? This is especially puzzling, since the watchtower has insightfully identified the two horned beast of Revelation with the modern Anglo-American dual world power. To preserve the natural harmony of the Bible's interrelated prophecies, the feet of iron and clay must symbolize the Anglo-American dyad. Since the metallic image seems to be in inverted order as well, with the feet of iron and clay upon which the entire image is standing, representing the most recent powers, the logical question is, what does the image itself represent? As discussed in a previous chapter, according to Revelation chapter 17, there is an eighth king that springs from the seven. So, the Anglo-American king is not the last king. He has a successor that rules for a prophetic 1 hour. The entire image, with its head of gold, which Daniel specifically interpreted to symbolize King Nebuchadnezzar himself, must represent the eighth and final king. that Nebuchadnezzar represents the final kingdom is made apparent in the prophecy of Isaiah. Specifically, chapters 13 through 14, where the king of Babylon is portrayed as the last of the goat-like rulers of the earth, who does not even receive an honorable burial, as has his predecessors, but is left to rot on the earth like the carcass of a slaughtered beast, just as Revelation depicts the vanquished last kingdom of earth in the aftermath of the war at Armageddon. Subheading: Thrown into the Burning Fiery Furnace. The third act of Daniel opens with Nebuchadnezzar ordering all the representatives of his far-flung empire to assemble themselves on the plain of Dura. The Bible account goes on to relate what took place there. At that time, the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the police magistrates, and all the administrators of their jurisdictional districts were assembling themselves for the inauguration of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. With great pomp and ceremony, the golden obelisk on the plains of Dura was to be inaugurated. The account further relates, "And the herald was crying out loudly, 'To you it is being said, O peoples, national groups, and languages, that at the same time that you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the zither, the triangular harp, the stringed instrument, the bagpipe, and all sorts of musical instruments, you fall down and worship the image of gold.'" According to the dimensions recorded in Daniel, the image was nearly 100 feet high. No doubt, the glittering golden idol was an impressive sight in the sunlight, intended to produce an overwhelming feeling of awe in those beholding it. But worship of the idol was not optional. By imperial decree, everyone present was to bow low before the image. Nebuchadnezzar even commanded that anyone who did not fall down and worship the golden image on command would at that very moment be thrown into the blazing furnace. It is noteworthy that Revelation 13:18 informs us that the mark of the beast is a man's number, a single man. Who is the man? Certainly, there are many opinions about various religious and political figures supposedly being the Antichrist. But there is no reason to resort to wild speculation in this matter. The very verse that refers to the man's number also exhorts would-be interpreters to use their wisdom and intelligence to calculate the significance of the enigmatic 666. Being the last prophetic book of the Holy Bible, Revelation draws upon the language, history, and symbolisms previously recorded in the Scriptures. That being the case, in order to intelligently decipher the mystery of the mark of the beast, it is necessary to turn to the Hebrew prophets. The Babylonian world power is described in prophecy as bringing about the crash and downfall of all nations. The 14th chapter of Isaiah refers to Babylon as tyrannizing the whole world. For example, Isaiah 14:6 describes Jehovah's ultimate judgment upon Babylon, saying, "The one striking peoples in fury, with a stroke incessantly, the one subduing nations in sheer anger, with a persecution without restraint. The whole earth has come to rest, has become free of disturbance." Verses 12 through 17 describe Babylon as a man, an individual, who seeks to exalt himself above the stars of God. The 16th verse says, "Is this the man that was agitating the earth, that was making kingdoms rock?" Interestingly, the image Nebuchadnezzar erected measured 60 by 6 cubits. It would appear, then, that the man, whose number is attached to the image of the beast of Revelation, is none other than Nebuchadnezzar himself. Nebuchadnezzar is also appropriately symbolized as the head of gold on the image that is ultimately destroyed by the kingdom of heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar typifies the absolutist type of tyrannical ruler that the eighth and final king is destined to become during the last hour, when all people will be put under compulsion to worship the state. Because of the vast reach of the Babylonian Empire, the massive gathering of representatives from all the jurisdictional districts and language groups pictures the world government that will come into existence with the reign of the eighth king. The eighth king will effectively subjugate the entire world of mankind, as did Nebuchadnezzar in a figurative way. In that respect, then, the golden image that was erected on the plains of Dura was a forerunner of the image of the beast represented in Revelation. The issue was certainly the same. Peoples of the world, and especially Jehovah's worshipers, will ultimately be confronted with the ultimatum to worship the state or die. Since our love for God is expressed by our obedience to Him, any compromise of our obedience constitutes idolatry, placing someone else or something in the place of God. The drama on the plains of Dura foreshadows how Satan will attempt to coerce all of Jehovah's worshipers into disobeying God, thus committing idolatry. Imagine the scene as thousands of men, perhaps tens of thousands, simultaneously prostrated themselves before the image as the ceremonial music began to play. No doubt, much like the Muslims do today when called to prayer by their mullahs. And there, three lone Hebrews conspicuously stood erect before the throng. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah stood for Jehovah's exclusive worship, literally. And when made to stand before the enraged king for having defied his express order, the three Hebrews unequivocally stated that they were not serving any of Babylon's gods, nor would they bow before the king's golden image. So Nebuchadnezzar ordered that the furnace be heated up 7 times hotter than normal, and into the roaring fire the three men were thrown. The flames were so intense that the guardsmen who bound them and threw them into the flames were the ones who perished. But there, in the midst of the fiery furnace, Nebuchadnezzar could not believe his eyes. The three Hebrews were casually standing in the midst of the blazing inferno, conversing with someone whom Nebuchadnezzar described as a son of the gods. Of course, all of Jehovah's Witnesses are familiar with the account, and every child who's ever gone to Sunday school has probably heard this story as well. But is it just a story that teaches a moral lesson, or is it a portent of realities not yet beheld? For a fact, Jehovah performed an extraordinary miracle on that occasion. But the most intriguing aspect of the account is the appearance of the fourth man in the furnace. Jehovah could have just as easily saved the three Hebrews without the appearance of the Son of the Gods. So what is the significance of his appearance in the drama? The one described by Nebuchadnezzar as resembling a son of the gods can be none other than the Son of God himself, Jesus Christ. How may that be determined? At Daniel 10:21, an angel informed the prophet that Michael was acting as the prince of you people meaning the Jews. So, undoubtedly, it was this Michael who appeared in the flames, standing alongside the three Hebrews. But what is the connection to Jesus? Daniel 12:1 further states, "And during that time, Michael will stand up, the great prince who is standing in behalf of the sons of your people. And there will certainly occur a time of distress such as has not been made to occur since there came to be a nation until that time. Not only was Michael, also known as the Archangel, the protective prince of the ancient Israelite nation, he is also the great prince who will act on behalf of Christians during the Great Tribulation, which, as Jesus also said, would be a time of distress like no other, and a time when all of the chosen ones will be gathered by God's holy angels. Keeping in mind the Greek word parousia literally means a coming alongside, the appearance of the great prince, Michael the Archangel, alongside the as-good-as-dead Hebrews in the fiery furnace, is a situational drama portraying how the chosen ones will be killed during the culmination of the parousia for not accepting the mark of the beast. But their martyrdom will result in their immediate transformation, as if in the blink of an eye, into the exact image of the Son of God himself. The three Hebrews in the furnace serve as a wraith-like portent for the remnant. The fact that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were not even singed by the flames portrays the immortality that is to be instantly conferred upon the chosen ones, making them impervious to death itself. Or as Jesus worded it, "Do not fear those who can kill the body, but cannot destroy the soul." Not coincidentally, at 1 Thessalonians 4:15-17, the Apostle Paul refers to the resurrection of the living holy ones during the parousia as taking place when Christ descends from the heavenly sphere with the commanding voice of an archangel. Parenthetically, the account in Daniel does not explain why Daniel was not also present for the inauguration of the image, and why he was not also subsequently thrown into the fiery furnace with his Hebrew companions. However, after the fall of Babylon, Daniel stayed on in the service of Darius and was appointed as one of three deputy rulers over 120 satrapies. Driven by envy, a conspiracy was fomented by the satraps to have Daniel done away with. As a result of the success of the conspirators, Daniel was thrown into a pit of lions. Ordinarily, that would have meant certain death. But as Daniel noted, God sent his angel to shut the mouths of the ravenous lions, and instead the king had the conspirators thrown into the pit, where they were immediately devoured. This event seems to parallel the experience of the three Hebrews being thrown into the fiery furnace and points to the crushing of the holy ones for their refusal to do homage to the last king, who will also be deputy rulers in the kingdom at that time, and how God will then turn the tables and destroy those who will conspire against them. Subheading: Chop down the tree and cut off its boughs. The fourth scene opens with King Nebuchadnezzar having yet another dream. Only this time he does not demand that his inept magic-practicing priest tell him his dream. But after his counselors failed to offer a satisfactory interpretation, the king called for his chief of the magic-practicing priests, Daniel. King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream of an immense tree that was chopped down by the decree of God, and the trunk of the tree was banded about with a metal strap for 7 times, after which the banding was removed and the stump was allowed to grow again. Daniel was inspired to interpret the dream as applying to King Nebuchadnezzar himself. His kingship was to be cut down, and he was to live like a wild beast of the field for 7 literal years, after which time he would be restored to his throne. The object of this lesson was to prove to Nebuchadnezzar, and all concerned, that Jehovah is the sole ruler in the kingdom of mankind, and no one can successfully oppose him or prevent him from accomplishing his will. God is fully capable of lifting up the lowliest of mankind and exalting them to the highest position. In this case, Nebuchadnezzar became the lowliest of mankind, becoming a virtual grass-eating lycanthrope, a man-beast. But the haughty king learned the lesson and acknowledged that Daniel's God was supreme. There have been many arrogant and godless rulers since Nebuchadnezzar, and none of them were humbled by heaven. As previously stated, the reason God inserted himself into the affairs of the king of Babylon was in order to assert his sovereignty. The reason being, because the city where Jehovah had placed his name, that is to say, Jerusalem, had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. Therefore, it became necessary to demonstrate that Babylon had merely been the earthly agency that God had used to accomplish his purpose. There is no question that the immense tree that was felled could apply, at least in principle, to the Jewish kingdom that Nebuchadnezzar had cut down. However, there is no mention of it in the context. Admittedly, the fact that the felled tree sprouted anew coincides with Jesus being called the twig from the stump of Jesse, the father of King David. And there's no question that the throne of David will be restored when Jesus takes up his kingship. But what about the seven times? Several decades before the Watchtower Society came on the scene, the Millerite movement and Adventist sects that sprang up afterwards developed various chronological calculations based upon the seven times of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Charles Russell readily accepted the seven times calculations and combined biblical chronology with occult pyramidology of that day to arrive at the date of 1914 as the year when the so-called Gentile times would end and the kingdom of Israel will be given to Christ. But as has already been established in a previous chapter, there is simply no justification for the assumption that the appointed times of the nations relates to the original destruction of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. The context of Jesus' prophecy clearly relates to the desolation of the holy place that was to occur before the generation of Christ's original disciples passed away. The prophecy of Daniel, as well as Revelation, not to mention most of the Hebrew prophets as well, foretell that the holy ones of the newly established kingdom are due to be trampled upon for a specified time, times, and half a time by the last king, and that the wild beast will attempt to change God's fixed times and seasons for the end of the present system of things to be accomplished. Although many of Jehovah's Witnesses undoubtedly find the Watchtower's adopted chronological calculations to be very compelling, it is well to keep in mind the fact that God allows an operation of error to go forth among his people, a deceptive operation of error aimed at convincing Christians that the presence of Christ has already commenced before the actual parousia begins. It should not be assumed that the promoters of an operation of error are unable to artfully contrive a convincing scriptural basis for their teaching. With that fact in mind, it may well be that the seven times were intended by God to simply serve as an unspecified period of time, but which primarily serves as the basis for the operation of the error that God has also made provision for until such time as Jesus Christ exposes the error and its lawless author. Ultimately, the meaning of the seven times may not be fully understood until the book of Daniel is unsealed during the time of the end. That the tree dream applied primarily to Nebuchadnezzar and the kingdom of Babylon, though, is emphasized in the fifth scene. That is where Nebuchadnezzar's son, or grandson as the case may have been, spread a banquet for 1,000 of his grandees, during which time King Belshazzar called for the golden goblets and other treasures pillaged from the house of Jehovah to be displayed before his guests. That is when the presumptuous king became terrified as he and his guests witnessed a disembodied hand suddenly appearing and begin writing on the palace wall. Daniel was called in to interpret the enigmatic Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parson for the ashen-faced monarch. Daniel prefaced his interpretation by calling to the king's attention the fact that God had humbled his father, a lesson that was apparently lost on his royal offspring. Even as Daniel spoke on that fateful night of October 5th and 6th, 539 BCE, Cyrus was leading the Medes and Persians up the mighty Euphrates in a stealth invasion of the doomed city of Babylon. The handwriting is on the wall has since become a common expression denoting inevitable doom. Eventually, a short-lived eighth king, an antitype of Babylon, will similarly be confronted with the divinely inscribed writing on the wall, and the chosen ones will serve as Daniel-like interpreters.